a distinguished guest and the national leaders of young democracy assembled here tonight. Maryland Democrats, both young and old, are proud to be in the forefront of that vast army of American citizens who are banded together with grim determination and irresistible force to make certain that the interests of the common people shall be preserved and that human rights shall be protected by the re-election of Franklin D. Roosevelt as President of the United States. On behalf of the Young Democratic Clubs of America and the Young Democratic Clubs of Maryland, I take this opportunity to express our sincere appreciation of the splendid cooperation, support, and advice of the leaders and rank and file of the Maryland democracy in making this occasion the success that it is. My friends of Maryland, it is a distinct honor for me to present to you my very warm friend, the illustrious leader of the Young Democratic Clubs of America, Frank Wickham of South Dakota.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, Mrs. Roosevelt, distinguished guests, young Democrats, and friends. The Young Democratic Club of America is proud and honored to have as its guest this evening the most outstanding citizen of our times. I am happy to present to you the President of the United States.
President Fetterman and President Wickham, and you, my friends, young and old, of Baltimore and Maryland and lots of other states. You who fill this great armory tonight, you represent a cross-section of millions of young people who have come to maturity since the year of grace 1929. You're the symbol of young men and women living in every state of the Union, affiliated with every political party, and belonging to every so-called stratum of society. The world in which the millions of you have come of age is not the set old world of your fathers. Some of yesterday's certainties have vanished, and many of yesterday's certainties are questioned. Why have some vanished? Why have many been questioned? Because the facts and because the needs of civilization have changed more greatly in this generation than in the century that preceded us. I need not press that point upon you. You are measuring the present state of the world out of your own experiences. You have felt the rough hand of the Depression. You've walked the streets looking for jobs that never turned up. And out of that has come physical hardship. But more serious out of that have come the scars of disillusionment. The temper of our youth has become more restless, more critical, more challenging. Flaming youth has become a flaming question. And youth comes to us wanting to know what we propose to do about a society that hurts so many of them. There is much to justify the inquiring attitude of youth. You have a right to ask these questions, practical questions. No man who seeks to evade or avoid deserves your confidence. Now I take it that many older people seem to take unmerited pride in the mere fact that they're adults. When youth comes crashing in on them with enthusiasms and ideals, they put on their most patronizing smiles and pat the young man or the young woman on the shoulder, and in a worldly wise sort of way, send them out with what they call their blessing. But as every young person knows, that is not a blessing, it's a cold shower. What they've really said to you is this: you're young, enjoy your enthusiasms and your ideals while you can, for when you grow up and get out in the world, you will know better. And the tragedy is that so many young people do just that. That they do grow up. And growing up, they grow away from their enthusiasms and their ideals. And that is one reason why the world into which they go gets better so slowly. Your objective, I take it, in the widest sense, is this: an opportunity to make an honest living, a reasonable chance to improve your condition in life as you grow older, a practical assurance against want and suffering in your old age, and with it all, the right to participate in the finer things of life. Good health, clean amusement, and your share in the satisfactions of the arts, the sciences, and religion. Faced with that objective, it is clear that many of the old answers are not the right answers. No answer, new or old, is fit for your thought unless it is framed in terms of what you face and what you desire, unless it carries some definite prospect of a practical, down-to-earth solution of your problems. During the next few months, you are going to read and hear, and I think you are going to be thoroughly bored by many so-called answers. Why, there are two or three or four new panaceas in every day's newspaper. Here's one that I picked out at random from three panaceas on the same page of one newspaper. The eminent author suggests a four-point cure for all of our ills. And I hope that you will be as thrilled and excited by them as I was. Here they are. One, establish a monetary unit with a definite gold content subject to change only by the Congress of the United States. Two, restore convertibility of money into gold coin and restore private ownership of gold. Three, I hope you understand what this means, I don't. Accept responsibility as the world's greatest creditor nation. Isn't that thrilling? And finally, put federal finances in order. Now I ask you, what do panacea planks like these offer to you as a way out of the problems that you've been facing today and will get up to face tomorrow morning? Is there opportunity? Is there work today? Is there assurance for tomorrow? Is this the practical, definite answer for which you've been looking? Most important of all in these panaceas, is there even a recognition in that type of panacea of the fact that the youth of America has any problems at all? No, my friends, you have a right to expect something better than that. You have a right to expect that those in authority will do everything within their power to help restore conditions that make employment and opportunity a possible thing. More than that, you have the right to expect that you will be protected insofar as is humanly possible from the physical and mental and spiritual ravages of economic and social maladjustment. Some counselors say confidence and normal prosperity will restore everything, will give us all jobs. They generally mean by that the confidence and the prosperity of 7 and 8 years ago. But my friends, 1928 and the first 7 or 8 months of 1929 There was no millennium. You and I know the simple fact that while production in our nation was increasing and profits were increasing, in 1928 and 1929, unemployment simultaneously was growing at an astounding rate. Return to the 1928 and 9 kind of prosperity is no sufficient answer for us. The best that the captains of industry, that the captains of the country could do for you before the Depression was not good enough then, and it is not good enough today. As you and I know now, we know that while the total production of America is about back to the high point before the Depression, only a little over 80% as many human beings are engaged in turning out that production. It does not matter very greatly what the cause of this is. It may be greater efficiency. It may be the development of new machinery. It may be a variety of other causes as well. We cannot legislate against a greater efficiency, nor can we legislate against the use of new tools, nor would we if we could. But the fact remains, and that fact requires an answer. Some people tell you that even with a completely restored prosperity, there will be a vast permanent army of the unemployed. I do not accept that. No man who is sensitive to human values dares to accept that. And that is why we are not content merely to restore what is sometimes called prosperity. We propose to attack the problem from every conceivable angle. We admit readily that a greater purchasing power, far more widely distributed, will mean the consumption of more goods, industrial products, and farm products. And we know that the production of more goods will mean more employment. Most businessmen, the great majority of them, believe with us that a greater purchasing power on the part of more people will help. They know that their own businesses will be helped thereby. To work in unity towards that end, constitutes one form of attack, an important one. But there are others that we must not overlook. Our working population in almost every part of the country increases every year that passes. Increases both because of population increase and because more and more women are working for wages, and that is as it should be. But when we face your problem, these increases raise the question as to whether it is not possible and right to limit the active working ages at both ends. We in your government are seeking to extend the school age of America, to extend it in every state in the Union, and to make it easier for boys and girls to stay in school. Work out for yourselves what would happen if all the boys and all the girls of 14 and 15 and 16 and 17 who are now working in industry, if all of them found it possible to stay in school until they were at least 18 years old. How many jobs would that give to the young people of the nation who have graduated from high school and graduated from college? And by no means the least important, how much better equipped would these youngsters be, these youngsters who are now at work, if they could stay in school through the completion of their education? And at the other end of life, in the same way, ask yourselves how many jobs would be created if the great majority of people who are now over some age, 65 to take a figure at random, if all of them were in a position to retire in security for the balance of their days on earth. And how much greater happiness would such security give to their old age and to the nation's old age? And there's another angle of re-employment, which from the point of view of youth is worth pursuing. I will point it by an illustration. In a certain manufacturing industry, comparatively a small industry, the average hours of weekly work were greatly curtailed under the operation of the National Industrial Recovery Act, and curtailed incidentally with the complete support of the great majority of employers within the industry. When this act came to an end, I will not describe its decease. When it came to an end, the average hours of work in that industry were a little over 36 hours per week. But since that time, the great majority of employers in this particular industry continued the old NRA scale of hours. But gradually, first a few and then a larger number of employers began lengthening the work week. And the result today is that the average of employment in this industry is nearly 40 hours per week. Not a serious difference, you say. And yet, if you figure it out on the assumption that there were 166,000 men and women in this industry, 10% of them, or 16,000 people, have either lost their jobs or by working longer hours are preventing 16,000 other people from getting employment. It seems reasonable, therefore, that industry can contribute in great measure to the increase of employment If industry as a whole will undertake reasonable reductions of hours of work per week, while at the same time they keep the average individual's pay envelope at least as large as it is today. It has always seemed to me that because the practices of employment definitely affect the problems of unemployment, the government must and the government will give consideration to such subjects as the length of the working week, the stability of employment on an annual basis, and the payment of at least adequate minimum wages. A government doing that is a government that is working actively at the answers to your problems. We do not yet know enough in a changing economic order to guarantee any nation permanently or completely against times of depression. We believe, however, that steps like these, which we have taken and are taking, will at least greatly cushion depression, will prevent the up curve from rushing to a violent, mad peak of false prosperity, and prevent another violent, mad descent into another sink of suffering and disillusionment, like the one from which, for the last 3.5 years, we have been surely emerging. And there is another aspect to the answer which you have a right to expect from us. We are doing, what are we doing? It is your question. What are we doing about the casualties of the Depression? Since 1929, those casualties in America have run into the millions. They are a charge upon us as a people. I have recognized that fact, and by every reasonable means, we have sought to care for those casualties, to keep them from the physical suffering of hunger, and to keep them from the mental suffering of a loss of American morale. In regard to all of these problems, in regard to every problem that confronts you, there are counselors these days who say, do nothing. And other counselors who say, do everything. But common sense dictates an avoidance of both extremes. I say to you, do something. And when you have done that something, if it works, do it some more. And if it does not work, then do something else.